It gives me great pleasure to welcome you back to the second Hirsch-Lauterkacht Memorial Lecture in the three-part series. We're delighted again to have Professor Yuval Shani from the Hebrew University in Jerusalem to give this second lecture today. He will continue from the discussion yesterday and then consider in particular jurisdiction in more detail. There is nobody who would be better placed to enlighten us about jurisdiction, both from a legal and policy perspective. He's written books on regulating jurisdiction between international courts and tribunals, and also about national courts and international tribunals. So we look forward to your second lecture. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mike. So thank you all for coming, especially those who are coming second night on a row. I admire your persistence. I will start with the point I picked up. I will pick up where I ended yesterday, where I tried to make the point that international judges reviewing jurisdiction and admissibility cases may confront a number of conflicts. On the one hand, they are expected, or they may be expected, to promote the attainment of the goals set for them explicitly or implicitly by their mandate providers that may militate in favor of focusing effort in some cases while putting less of an emphasis on other cases. That is, selecting those cases that would best advance the court's normative agenda, and indeed, as we shall see in a moment, the construction of jurisdiction and admissibility provisions appears to have sometimes been influenced by teleological considerations. On the other hand, legitimacy concerns, as well as respect for the rule of law, may restrict the court's ability to advance a normative agenda and to select cases that run contrary to the explicit delegation of power to the court by the mandate providers and to the consent to the court's jurisdiction by the parties. This may push courts in the direction of textualism in interpreting jurisdictional provisions and requiring a clear proof of party consent to jurisdiction. By overextending or underreading the letter of the law governing jurisdictional and admissibility issues, courts may reduce their ability to allude to the determinacy of the standard in question as the basis of the decision's legitimacy. Furthermore, by moving away from interpretations based on the four corners of the constitutive text, chances increase that legal provisions would be construed in an inconsistent manner to accommodate unique case selection considerations, an issue I will discuss tomorrow in connection with the series of decisions relating to Yugoslavia that was discussed before the court in the last 16 years. And in such cases, the coherence and fairness of the court's approach to jurisdictional issues may be challenged. Finally, to the extent that the theological reading of the jurisdictional and inadmissibility provision stands in tension with basic principles of international law, which may be reflected in the court's constitutive instruments, such as consent or pacta sunt servanda, additional legitimacy concerns are raised, couched in Frankian notions of adherence. Such concerns about legitimacy and legality may have led at the time ICC judges of the International Court of Justice to reject Judge Alvarez's call in the Anglo-Iranian case to construe the ICJ statute as allowing for compulsory jurisdiction in certain cases without explicit authorization in the statute itself. So adjudicators are sometimes presented with a choice between fidelity to the goals of the regime they serve and the actual treaty text which delineates their powers. An example of such a conflict can be found in a 2004 decision rendered by an ICSID arbitration tribunal in the case of Tokyo Tokelis, a case involving the investment in Ukraine by a Lithuanian company controlled by Ukrainian shareholders. The question in that case was whether giving the particular features of the investment, namely that the ultimate control over the investment is in the hands of local investors and not foreign investors, the foreign investment in question, so to speak, the question arose whether this is a foreign investment that falls under the jurisdiction of ICSID. The majority on the tribunal comprising, interestingly enough, of the two party-appointed arbitrators for the two different parties, were of the view that their powers to decline jurisdiction are constrained by the text of the jurisdictional conferring instrument, which did not create an exception for foreign investors controlled by local investors. And I quote, "We find no basis in the BIT, the Bilateral Investment Treaty, or the convention, the ICSID convention, to set aside the contracting parties' agreed definition of corporate nationality with respect to investors of either party in favor of a test based on the nationality of the controlling shareholder. On the other hand, the president of the tribunal, Professor Prosper Weil, took the opposite view and voted against hearing the case using teleological interpretive arguments," and again I quote, "to maintain, as the decision does, that the origin of the capital is not relevant, runs counter to the object and purpose of the whole ICSID system. Of course, considerations of legitimacy and effectiveness do not always stand in conflict with one another, as the simple text of the jurisdictional provision in question may be closely aligned with the court's broader goals. For example, when deciding to construe the test of complementarity in a minimalist manner, which prioritizes inaction by the state, the territorial state, namely lack of investigation or prosecution over other indications of unwillingness or inability or willingness or ability to investigate or prosecute, the ICC held in Katanga, a 2009 decision, that to hold otherwise would be not only irreconcilable with the wording of the provision, but also in conflict with a purposive interpretation of the statute. The aim of the Rome Statute is to put an end to impunity. This object and purpose of the statute would come to naught were the said interpretation of Article 17.1 of the statute, as proposed by the appellant, were to prevail. But even when no perfect compatibility between texts and goals exist, one must acknowledge that the two sets of considerations, effectiveness and legitimacy, cannot be fully divorced from one another. An ineffective court may lose its legitimacy in the eyes of relevant constituencies, and vice versa. An illegitimate court is unlikely to be effective. In other words, in order to function, courts must retain a minimal amount of both effectiveness and legitimacy. It is rather a question of assigning relative weights to the two values and engaging in certain trade-offs between them in specific cases. Arguably, for each court, a different point of equilibrium would be optimal. Moreover, such equilibrium may change over time in light of changes in the political or legal environment or in other fields related to the problem area addressed by the court. An example of an attempt to strike a new equilibrium between text and telos can be found, for example, in two ECJ, European Court of Justice, decisions in Levelt versus Parliament and Parliament versus Council, two decisions rendered in the 1980s, involving the extension of the European Parliament's right to sue and be sued in annulment actions beyond the jurisdictional provisions found in the Rome Treaty as they stood at the time. In both cases, the European Court suggested that such a legal development is necessary to maintain the institutional balance between the various community institutions, that is, to attain the goal of regime support, especially in light of the increased involvement of Parliament in lawmaking in the European community. In the circumstances of these cases, it appears as if the accountability-enhancing aspects of the decisions and the growing political consensus around the need, on the one hand, to empower the European Parliament, but on the other hand, to introduce more checks on the power exercised by European institutions as the way to reduce the democratic deficit in Europe, has offset any loss of legitimacy incurred by the act of judicial legislation performed by the court in those cases. Ironically, perhaps, the court noted in Levertz that the community order is built around the rule of law. In support of its decision to ignore the letter of the law and to introduce a broader right of judicial review of administrative measures than the Treaty of Rome has provided. An additional factor which further complicates the choice between texts and goals is the idiosyncratic institutional interest of the court in question, which can militate in favor or against accepting jurisdiction in a specific case. Thus, for example, some commentators have cynically attributed the propensity of many arbitral tribunals to retain jurisdiction to the financial incentive that arbitrators may have of getting paid for hearing the case on the merits. But more seriously, perhaps, a court may be interested in hearing a case in order to increase its caseload or its perceived relevance to a certain policy problem area, or to the contrary, to refrain from taking too many cases that would overcrowd its docket, or specifically to take politically sensitive cases which may harm its reputation or lead to unhealthy splits among the judges. Thus, for example, Sean Murphy, a U.S. commentator, has suggested a reading of the ICJ's controversial decision on jurisdiction in Nicaragua as an attempt by the court to expand the reach of its power, as well as an attempt by the court to reposition itself in the world of international institutions. And I quote from his work on the field, having stood up to the United States in the Nicaragua case, the court became a hero to the states of the developing world and ushered in a period of increased activity on its docket. It is possible that the advisory opinion in Kosovo of last year is indicative of an opposite approach, a narrowest possible reading of the court's jurisdiction in order to avoid dealing with a politically explosive matter. Once an international court is established, it is endowed with jurisdiction in abstracto. Namely, it has general powers to adjudicate certain category of cases. Thus, foundational jurisdictional provisions, sometimes described as primary or basic jurisdiction provisions, found in the constitutive instruments of the relevant court and supplemented at time with general international law norms, usually include a definition of the key features attendant to the disputes or situations which the court is authorized to adjudicate, what we normally would refer to as jurisdiction ratione persona, ratione materia, ratione temporis, ratione loci, as well as preconditions for the exercise of jurisdiction. Traditionally, the constitutive instruments of international courts establish the consent of the parties to the adjudication, in a specific case, or to a category of cases, as the most important precondition to the before the exercise of jurisdiction. Although, as we have seen with the rise of courts endowed with compulsory jurisdiction, the centrality of this condition has been declining. In any event, it is clear that the parties have an implicit power under the constitutive instruments of most international courts to stipulate upon the jurisdiction, the principal jurisdictional features of those courts that are dispositive in nature, namely not related to the court's core functions, thus its such as its legitimacy and effectiveness. Parties to disputes refer to adjudication may limit the court's scope of jurisdiction over specific cases, or where the court's constitutive instruments so permit, they may also expand the scope of the court's jurisdiction. Hence, for example, it is common for agreements referring future disputes to the ICJ to limit the consent ratione temporis to disputes arising after a certain date. An example would be Article 27 of the European Convention for the Peaceful Settlement of Disputes, which excludes from the jurisdiction of the ICJ disputes relating to facts or situations prior to the entry into force of this convention between the parties to the dispute, or to introduce additional preconditions to adjudication, such as those found in Article 22 of the CERD Convention, which was the subject of the recent Georgia versus Russia case. At the same time, some constitutive instruments allow the parties to agree to expand the foundational jurisdiction of the relevant international court or tribunal beyond its normal scope of coverage, or to remove one of the antecedent conditions to the exercise of jurisdiction. For instance, Article 25(2)(b) of the ICSID Convention authorizes the parties to a dispute to agree to extend the jurisdiction ratione persona of the center to cases involving juridical persons having the nationality of the whole state, who, because of foreign control, the parties have agreed should be treated as a national of another contracting party for the purposes of this convention. In the same vein, an agreement to waive diplomatic protection, a possibility explicitly discussed by the International Court of Justice in the Elsie case, would remove a precondition that would otherwise restrict the jurisdiction of the court. The upshot of this analysis is that one encounters two principal sets of jurisdictional authorizations and conditions: a foundational mandate found in the constitutive instrument and supplemented by general international law, and a specific grant of jurisdiction by those states and or other authorized international actors who are either the direct parties to the dispute or closely related to the situation at hand, such as the states of nationality of a suspected criminal, or the state of nationality of a foreign investor. And I'm not suggesting that the two categories are parallel. As a result, one can discuss the jurisdiction of any international court in abstracto or in concreto. Did the combination of general and specific authorizations and conditions brought a particular dispute or situation under the authority of the court? Unfortunately, examination of the literature and the case law shows considerable confusion and inconsistency in employing the four principal categories that I have identified: foundational jurisdiction, general conditions, specific jurisdiction, and specific conditions. For example, the International Court of Justice has treated in the NATO use of force case of 2004 its foundational jurisdiction ratione personae over state parties to the statute or jurisdiction conferring treaties in force as a question of access. And I quote, "The court can exercise its judicial function only in respect of those states which have access to it under Article 35 of the statute, and only those states which have access to the court can confer jurisdiction upon it." I should note that the court perhaps softened this distinction between access and jurisdiction in the Bosnian Genocide decision of 2007, the judgment of 2007, where it was held that questions of right of access may be seen as an element in establishing jurisdiction. And again, I quote, "The question whether a state has the capacity under the statute to be a party to proceedings before the court may be regarded as an issue prior to that of jurisdiction ratione persona, or as one constitutive element within the concept of jurisdiction ratione persona." While it may make very little difference in practical terms whether the term access or foundational jurisdiction is used, I would like, however, to perhaps comment on two aspects of this distinction between access and foundational jurisdiction. First, it is important to know that access should be understood as merely one element of foundational jurisdiction, thus the overall powers conferred upon the court by the mandate providers. There are other foundational jurisdictional aspects which enjoy a similar preliminary status. For example, for the International Court of Justice, the foundational jurisdiction ratione materia is very broad, encompassing all international disputes. But for many other courts, such preliminary aspect, is much more restricted in nature, typically tied to the interpretation and application of a specific treaty, or limited to a specific area of international law, such as investment, human rights, or the interpretation or application of agreements related to the purposes of the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea. Similarly, foundational jurisdiction ratione temporis provisions restrict the ability of courts to hear cases arising before or after a certain date. Like access provisions, these general jurisdictional provisions constrain the power of the court and limit the powers of authorization and consent that may be held by the parties to litigation. The second aspect, for which the use of the term access perhaps doesn't fully capture, is the hierarchical relationship between foundational and specific jurisdiction, that is, between the overall capacities delegated to an international court by its mandate providers and the specific authorization it may have obtained from the parties. Whereas no conflict arises between the two concepts if the former is broader than the latter, if the foundational jurisdiction is broader than the specific jurisdiction, the opposite is not always true. The parties to a dispute cannot request the court to exceed its overall powers unless the constitutive instruments make arrangements to this effect. This holding was explicitly confirmed by the International Court of Justice in the NATO use of force decision, which I already mentioned, of 2004. And again, I quote, "A distinction has to be made between a question of jurisdiction that relates to the consent of a party and the question of the right of a party to appear before the court under the requirements of the statute, which is not a matter of consent. The question is whether, as a matter of law, Serbia and Montenegro was entitled to seize the court as a party to the statute at the time when it instituted proceedings in these cases. Since the question is independent of the views or wishes of the parties, even if they were now to have arrived at a shared view on this point, the court would not have to accept this view as necessarily the correct one. The function of the court is to inquire into the matter and reach its own conclusions, and it is thus mandatory upon the court, irrespective of the consent of the parties, and is in no way incompatible with the principle that the jurisdiction of the court depends on consent." the reason for this hierarchical relationship between foundational and jurisdictional, foundational and specific jurisdiction, is threefold. First, the constitutive instruments of the court are prior in time to the specific authorization issued by the specific parties, and they facilitate and regulate those specific exercises of jurisdiction. In other words, when the parties invoke the jurisdiction of an existing international court, as opposed to a situation where the parties establish an international court, the constitutive instrument of that existing court are the source of authority that they must invoke. This structure leads by necessary implication to an hierarchical priority of the delegating instrument over the delegated one. Second, international courts are public institutions in the sense that they are created and maintained by a multiplicity of states and possibly also other actors such as IGOs. It would run contrary to a basic principle of international law if a subset of parties were capable, by way of a bilateral agreement, to change the legal norms established by the broader multiple body of mandate providers that governs the jurisdiction of the court without the consent of these mandate providers. This is especially so since the invocation of the jurisdiction of international courts may entail certain costs for these third parties, certainly in time in terms of incurring the additional operational costs in the area of budget in the area of budgets and judicial time, but also perhaps with regard to the court's ability to focus on its principal goals and to continue to enjoy broad acceptability. These latter interests may be compromised if the courts were allowed to be hijacked by certain parties and instructed to perform judicial missions unrelated to their original mandate. These considerations explain why international courts are expected to examine foundational jurisdictional aspects, including foundational preconditions, proprio motu, that is, in order to protect the rights and interests of the mandate providers. Therefore, the dicta used by the Permanent Court of International Justice in minority schools in Upper Silesia, a 1928 case, where the court held that the raising of an objection by one party merely draws the attention of the court to an objection to the jurisdiction which it must ex officio consider, that proposition is correct as far as it pertains to matters of foundational jurisdiction. In respect of such issues, the parties may insist that they would be decided in preliminary proceedings, but they cannot waive these issues altogether. Finally, foundational jurisdiction, being an aspect of the court structure, influences not only the court's goal attainment potential, but also other aspects of its structure and procedures which are geared towards supporting the exercise of the court's foundational jurisdiction. Permitting parties to extend the jurisdiction of the court by way of agreement without undertaking the structural and procedural reforms that may be needed to facilitate such exercise of jurisdiction may create serious practical difficulties for the court in question. One recent example of difficulties created by a procedure that was arguably not envisioned by the mandate providers can be found in the very recent ICJ advisory opinion on ILO Administrative Tribunal /IFAD, where the court strongly criticized a request by an IGO for review of an administrative tribunal ruling issued against that organization in the form of advisory opinion. According to the court, this process of these advisory proceedings violate the principle of equality of the parties. And I quote, "The court is unable to see any such justification for the provision for review of the tribunal's decision which favors the employer to the disadvantage of the staff member." Still, in the circumstances of the case, the court held that the flaws in the process were not sufficiently compelling in nature to justify its decline of jurisdiction. Using the general terms I just abused, one can regard the IFAD request as an attempt to utilize the court for a labor dispute, arguably a use of the International Court of Justice that was not anticipated by the mandate providers, who in fact revoked in 1995 the parallel system of review that existed for the United Nations administrative tribunals. And this pushed the court to hear a case which its current procedures are ill-equipped to accommodate without the greater equality of arm provisions that were created at the time for the United Nations administrative tribunal review cases through a standing committee on applications for review. Still, if it is indeed right that as a matter of law and policy, foundational jurisdiction controls the specific authorization conferred upon the court by the party to a specific case, then I would propose that the legal soundness of the decision of the International Court of Justice in the Bosnian Genocide case of 2007 to accord its 1996 judgment on the preliminary objections, the status of res judicata, could be questioned. Arguably, the parties cannot confer on the court more powers than its constitutive instruments conferred upon it or facilitated conferring upon it, and as a result, a judgment allowing a party without a right of access to participate in court proceedings would be ultra vires and should be regarded as invalid, notwithstanding the strong judicial economy interests opposing the reopening of cases. This view, which was expressed by the joint dissent in that case, by Judges Vanjiva, Shi, and Koroma, which I now quote, that the scope and effect of res judicata for purposes of jurisdiction ratione materia must be determined by reference to the law of the case itself, in this case, whether the parties had access to the court and whether the requirements of the charter and the statute for a party to appear before the court were met, appeared to me to be thus therefore preferable to the arguments offered by the majority. Now, before proceeding further to discuss the main categories of jurisdiction and to describe the actual role of different types of jurisdiction and preconditions to jurisdiction, it may be useful to offer a few remarks on the relationship between jurisdiction preconditions and substantive law, the substantive issues that could be discussed, that are discussed in the cases before the court. Now, of course, the question of jurisdiction, the power to adjudicate, is analytically distinct from the substantive question, what rights and obligations are implicated in the review transaction. Still, in actuality, the two sets of issues are not always neatly distinguishable. First, decisions on jurisdiction and on the merits of the case may rest on a common factual or legal basis. For instance, whether a certain agreement is valid or not. Second, a failure on the part of the applicant to show that the respondent has undertaken an opposable legal obligation on which it may rely could imply that the court in question did not have the authority to hear the case from the start, that is, that the claim was ill-founded. Thus, the distinctions I will offer below are not always sharp in nature, and courts have considerable procedural discretion in navigating between them or around them. I will try to illustrate this point through some examples. First, in military and paramilitary activities in Nicaragua, the 1984 decision, the ICJ was confronted with a U.S. objection to its jurisdiction based on the Vandenberg Amendment, excluding from the scope of the American consent to jurisdiction disputes arising under a multilateral treaty, unless all parties to the treaty affected by the decision are also parties to the case before the court, or the United States of America specifically agrees to jurisdiction. The court held that the application of this jurisdictional condition requires the identification of those parties affected by the decision. However, such identification can only occur at the merit stage after the substantive rights and obligations of the parties have been identified. Only then the effects of adjudication on the rights and interests of third parties can be assessed. In other words, and I quote now, it is only when the general lines of the judgment to be given become clear that the states affected could be identified. In such circumstances, the court appears to have had no choice but to rule that the objection to jurisdiction does not have an exclusively preliminary character pursuant to Rule 79.7, now 79.9, of the Rules of Court, and to join in effect the jurisdictional and substantive stages of the procedure. Another example of intertwined jurisdictional and substantive questions can be found in the Anglo-Iranian oil judgment, where the court held inter alia that a certain concession contract concluding between Iran and a UK corporation with some British government involvement cannot serve as the basis for the court's jurisdiction since the UK was not a party to the agreement, and as a result there was no privity of contract between the government of Iran and the government of the United Kingdom. Now, this holding was criticized by Judge Reed, one of the dissenting judges in the case, who thought that the UK claim that the concession contract amounted to an implied agreement between the two governments was an essential part of the UK claim on the merits of the case and should therefore have been dismissed preliminary and should not have therefore been dismissed preliminarily in the jurisdictional phase of the proceedings. And now I quote from his opinion, the court is not competent in preliminary proceedings and under the relevant provisions of the statutes and the statute and the rules to decide whether or not an international agreement arose between the two governments in 1933, one fully operative as creating an obligation in international law. I have reached the conclusion that the competence of the court at this stage is limited to deciding whether the alleged international agreement, assuming, and this is the key phrase, assuming that the United Kingdom's contentions as regards its nature and scope are well-founded, is a treaty or convention within the meaning of the declaration. In other words, Judge Reed advocates a procedural rule offering to take at the jurisdictional stage of the proceedings the applicant's claims about law and facts at their highest, a position which would limit the court's case selection power at the preliminary objection stage of the proceedings. A variant of this approach was in fact applied by the International Court of Justice in its decision in the second phase of the Southwest Africa case in 1966, where it held that its first decision in the first phase of the proceedings on the survival of the South Africa League of Nations mandate was only provisional in nature. And again, I quote, the 1962 decision on the question of competence was equally given without prejudice to that of the survival of the mandate, which is a question appertaining to the merits of the case. It was not in issue in 1962, except in the sense that the survival had to be assumed for the purpose of determining the purely jurisdictional issue, which was all that was then before the court. As a result, because of this assumption, rebuttable assumption, the case could have been reopened again. In any event, the International Court of Justice was of the view that a decision on a preliminary objection can never be preclusive of a matter appertaining to the merits, whether or not it has in fact been dealt with in connection with the preliminary objection. This arguendo approach to jurisdictional claims taken by Judge Reed and probably supported by the South West Africa case, certainly protects the formal separation between the two stages of the proceedings. However, it may prove to be excessively cumbersome procedurally, as it may require the court to hear a full case, notwithstanding its ability to summarily reject it on the basis of one weak element in the case, which features mixed jurisdictional and substantive aspects. In all events, it appears as if some courts have been explicitly granted discretion in deciding whether or not to reject preliminarily a case which looks legally weak on the substance. For instance, the European Court of Human Rights has been authorized under Article 35 of the European Convention to reject ill-founded applications. Interestingly, this court, probably the most burdened court of them all, was recently granted an additional power under Protocol 14 of the Convention, that is the authority to summarily dispose of cases which raise easy questions. I quote from Article 28.2b of the Convention as it stands now, that provision authorizes a committee of judges to declare an application admissible, but also to render at the same time a judgment on the merits if the underlying question in the case concerns the interpretation or application of the convention or protocols thereto is already the subject of well-established case law of the court. As noted before, a second category of cases raising the relationship between jurisdictional issues, including conditions for jurisdiction and substantive claims, involve those cases where the claimant fails to substantiate any prima facie right against the respondent. This is, of course, the essence of the distinction offered by the ICJ in the second phase of the Southwest Africa case. And again, I quote, a distinction has to be made between, on the one hand, the right to activate a court and the right of the court to examine the merits of the claim, and on the other hand, the plaintiff's party's legal right in respect of the subject matter of which it claims, which would have to be established to the satisfaction of the court. So there is this sharp distinction. However, some courts have not maintained this distinction and treated situations where no substantive rights can be claimed on the part of the applicant as justifying dismissal, notwithstanding the absence of any other jurisdictional flow in the application. For example, the European Court of Human Rights has held in the Bankovic case of 2001 that an application brought against a number of NATO member states alleging their responsibility for the attack on a TV station in Belgrade on 23 April 1999, that this case is inadmissible because of the lack of a jurisdictional link between the victims and the respondent states. In the same vein, in a 2007 judgment called Berami, the court has held that an application brought against states contributing forces to the international presence in Kosovo is incompatible ratione persona with the provisions of the convention, since it was the UN and not the individual states that bore responsibility. Now, in my view, both cases really do not involve a finding on jurisdiction. They rather feature a preliminary decision on the merits of the case. That is, they discuss whether the respondent states have violated any legal obligations they owed under the convention to the applicants. Such questions are really analogous in nature to the question of legal standing described by the International Court of Justice in the second phase of the Southwest Africa case, which Justice Fitzmaurice described at the time as questions appertaining to the merits but having an antecedent character. Thus, the two decisions by the European Court of Human Rights shouldn't have been analyzed as jurisdictional in nature, notwithstanding the use of the term jurisdiction to describe the substantive scope of application of the convention, but rather as questions of admissibility, or questions of merits having an antecedent character. Note, however, that the problem in classification I have alluded to does not raise any practical problem within the context of the European Convention on the Human Rights, because the court is authorized under that convention, as I just noted, to reject as inadmissible petitions which would be manifestly ill-founded or incompatible with the provisions of the convention. Furthermore, under the European Convention, the court may address issues of admissibility at any stage of the proceedings. As a result, that specific court has considerable discretion to decide whether or not to address substantive issues of an antecedent character during the jurisdictional phase of the case or during proceedings on the merits. Arguably, considerations of judicial economy, as well as the political inconvenience that may have accompanied the prolonged adjudication of the human rights allegations brought against international forces involved in the intervention in Kosovo, has led the court to deal with the antecedent issue of the scope of protection offered by the convention in a relatively early stage of the proceedings. It is more difficult to justify from a procedural point of view, however, the holding of the International Court of Justice in the provisional measures phase of the NATO use of force case of 1999, the court does not have prima facie jurisdiction, and as a result cannot issue provisional measures, inter alia because it does not appear to it that the attacks described in Yugoslavia's application entail the intent to destroy a group. As required by the Genocide Convention, which was one of the heads of jurisdiction claimed by Yugoslavia. While there is little doubt that the genocide part of the claim was ill-founded, and perhaps was also an abusive process, and should have led a court authorized at a preliminary at a provisional measures or an interim order stage to reject applications on the basis of likelihood of lack of likelihood of prevailing on the merits, it is questionable whether the allusion to prima facie lack of jurisdiction was accurate by the court. The order represented, in my mind, a discretionary decision by the court not to use its power, and should have been presented and justified as such, arguably, under the heading of grounds of admissibility, relying upon either implied or inherent powers that the court may have to reject abusive claims. Interestingly enough, the whole issue of genocide was not further pursued, or the prima facie applicability of the Genocide Convention was not further pursued in the 2004 judgment on the preliminary objections. A third group of interactions between jurisdictional provisions and substantive law exists in cases where there is lack of clarity as to whether a specific precondition is jurisdictional or substantive in nature. Such a question arises most frequently in diplomatic protection cases. In some cases, exhaustion of local remedies has been regarded by international courts as a jurisdictional precondition. This is essentially the position taken in European Court of Human Rights cases, such as Aksoy versus Turkey, attaching to a specific category of cases brought by states on behalf of the nationals, or even in cases such as the European Court of Human Rights cases, brought by these directly by those affected individuals. Still, exhaustion of local remedies was sometimes described as a substantive element in the state's claim, in whose absence no violation of international law vis-a-vis the state of nationality has occurred. This appears to have been the position taken by the International Court of Justice Chamber in the Elsie case, where it was held that exhaustion is a question that should be decided at the outset of the merits stage of the proceedings, as a question of antecedent nature. This position appears to have been cited with approval by the commentary to Article 44 of 2001 Draft Articles on State Responsibility. Furthermore, in denial of justice cases, exhaustion has been treated as a substantive precondition which precludes the establishment of any violation of international law, even vis-a-vis the individual in question. For instance, the authority supporting this proposition is the Lowen case, 2003. These differences in qualification may affect not only the question of what would be the proper procedural stage for discussing questions of exhaustion, but could also affect the interpretive framework within which such claims are analyzed. Thus, for instance, the very liberal approach taken by the European Court of Human Rights in the Aksoy case, which I mentioned before with regard to the issue of exhaustion, can be understood as part of that court's general pro-protection bias that pushes it to construe its own powers and its own jurisdictions rather liberally, whereas the stricter approach applied in Lowen vis-à-vis the question of exhaustion may reflect the high threshold that court attributed to a claim which is framed in terms of substantive denial of justice. A key aspect of jurisdiction in the law governing international courts is the duty to exercise it, which the grant of authority entails. Courts serve in this respect as agents or trustees on behalf of their principals, which are the mandate providers and the parties to the dispute. Thus, unless courts identify a valid reason not to exercise the power granted to them, recognized explicitly or implicitly in the jurisdiction conferring instruments or international law, they must exercise their jurisdiction, notwithstanding the implications of the case for the court's workload, political standing, or internal divisions. Indeed, an ad hoc committee has held in the Vivendi case, and I quote, that it is settled and neither party disputes that an ICSID tribunal commits an excess of power, not only if it exercises a jurisdiction which it does not have under the relevant agreement or treaty and the ICSID convention read together, but also if it fails to exercise a jurisdiction which it possesses under those instruments. In the same vein, the WTO appellate body has emphasized that it has no discretion on whether it should or should not take a case better addressed by another more appropriate forum. Thus, for example, in Mexico Soft Drinks, a 2006 report, the appellate body held, and I quote, the fact that a member state may initiate a WTO dispute whenever it considers that any benefits accruing to it are being impaired by measures taken by another member implies that the member is entitled to a ruling by a WTO panel. A decision by a panel to decline to exercise validly established jurisdiction would seem to diminish the right of a complaining member to seek the redress of a violation of obligation within the meaning of Article 23, and to bring a dispute pursuant to Article 3.3. This would not be this wouldn't be consistent with the panel's obligation under Articles so and so of the DSU. The International Court of Justice has also emphasized in a number of advisory opinions that because the advisory competence is discretionary in nature, namely that it is not required, it is not obliged to provide an advisory opinion, underscoring thereby perhaps the non-discretionary and the mandatory nature of its contentious jurisdiction, namely the lack of any discretion on the matter. So on its face, the non-discretionary nature of the duty to exercise jurisdiction deprives courts, by and large, of the power to engage in case selection and may render, as a result, their task somewhat more difficult. As I have already suggested, without control of the dockets, courts cannot prioritize cases, nor can they avoid politically sensitive or embarrassing decisions that may adversely affect their legitimacy. Still, in practice, the process of establishing the jurisdiction of international courts over disputes appear to inevitably contain strong discretionary features, which open up a gap between legal doctrine and judicial practice in this field. First, we have already seen that courts may have some discretion in sequencing certain aspects of the case, and may deal preliminarily with questions relating to the merits that have an antecedent character, in effect, allowing them to dismiss a case for a lack of claim on the merits without engaging in a full treatment of the party's arguments. Secondly, we will see further, that would be tomorrow, that some constitutive instruments of some courts authorize them to apply discretionary grounds of inadmissibility that pertain to considerations of justice, propriety, and judicial economy. Such courts are thus constitutionally empowered to engage in case selection. Still, perhaps the most dramatic area where judicial discretion is employed to select cases is the area of interpretation of relevant jurisdictional provisions. So, whereas courts are not typically authorized to decline to exercise jurisdiction bestowed upon them by reason of policy considerations relating to their effectiveness of legitimacy, they may rely on such considerations explicitly or implicitly in order to decide whether they have jurisdiction to begin with. Such discretionary interpretation of the court's scope of jurisdiction may result in the inclusion of certain categories of cases within the court's jurisdiction, and the exclusion of certain categories of cases from the court's jurisdiction, in other words, in case selection. Now, the list of decisions which illustrate the role of policy considerations in jurisdictional determinations issued by international courts is quite long and cannot be covered exhaustively here. I will give, however, a few examples illustrating some policy considerations that led or may have led to a decision, sometimes noted explicitly and sometimes perhaps implicitly. For example, the recent CER judgment, the judgment in the case between Russia and Georgia and Russia, where the issue in question was how to construe the term dispute which is not settled, a condition for jurisdiction introduced by Article 22 of the CER, which allegedly by Russia entails a duty to exhaust alternative methods of dispute resolution prior to referral of the case to the referral of the case to the International Court of Justice, an interpretation which the court eventually accepted, namely that the condition has been introduced here, as opposed to the alternative interpretation offered by Georgia, that the term dispute which is not settled is not a condition but rather a description of a state of affairs. Namely, if the dispute has not been settled, if the dispute is still ongoing, it is not. It can be referred to the court. So Georgia essentially proposed a very narrow construction of the provision, focusing on the lack of settlement, whereas Russia proposed a broader interpretation focusing on the positive duty to engage, to actively engage in alternative dispute settlement. The court sided with Russia and noted in support the following policy arguments. Such resort to alternative dispute settlement fulfills three distinct functions. In the first place, it gives notice to the respondent state that the dispute exists and delimits the scope of the dispute and its subject matter. The PCAJ was aware of this when it stated in the Mavromatis case that before a dispute can be made the subject of an action in law, its subject matter should have been clearly defined by means of diplomatic negotiations. In the second place, it encourages the parties to attempt to settle their dispute by mutual agreement, thus avoiding recourse to binding third-party adjudication. In the third place, prior resort to negotiations or other methods of peaceful dispute settlement performs an important function in indicating the limit of consent given by states. So put differently, the interpretation of a foundational jurisdictional condition, what is dispute that has been settled, is supported by considerations of judicial economy, namely the need to delimit the dispute before its submission to adjudication, general policy concerns about promoting more generally the efficiency in the management of international disputes, namely the promotion of non-judicial methods of peaceful dispute resolution, and judicial legitimacy, ensuring the consent of the parties to the various aspects of the case referred to the court. The central role of consent in the work of the court, which is found more generally expression in its canon of interpretation of specific jurisdictional provisions seeking to identify the actual intent of the parties to the case, can be understood as another policy consideration which seeks to strengthen the sole legitimacy of the court, namely to ensure that cases that are formally consented to actually represent the actual intent of the parties to the case. An example of such a case is the fisheries jurisdiction case of 1996, where the court actually focused on the intention of Canada in submitting the reservation to the declaration as the prominent reason to exclude a specific dispute from the court's jurisdiction. As I noted yesterday, another explanation for such a decision may have been the concern, the policy, or the institutional concern by the court not to deter states from depositing declarations of acceptance of jurisdiction which feature reservations. The court may have been concerned that in the event that it would construe narrowly a reservation to jurisdiction, states would simply withdraw existing declarations or refrain from submitting new ones. In some cases, policy considerations appear to have caused the International Court of Justice to assume jurisdiction, notwithstanding certain procedural flaws in the process of authorization. So policy considerations may limit the jurisdictional powers of the court, but they may also expand them. For instance, in military and paramilitary activities in Nicaragua, the court was willing to downplay the significance of certain irregularities in the process by which Nicaragua had accepted the court's compulsory jurisdiction under the optional clause, inter alia because it took the position that it would be unfair to prevent Nicaragua from relying on the court's own publication, which considered Nicaragua to be an optional clause state. And I quote, if the court were to object that Nicaragua ought to have made a declaration under Article 36, Paragraph 2, it would be penalizing Nicaragua for having attached undue weight to the information given on that point by the court and the Secretary General of the United Nations, and in some having, on account of the authority of their sponsors, regarded them as more reliable than they really were. So in other words, the court seemed to imply that considerations of procedural fairness may affect the determinations of its legal powers and could justify, in this case, an interpretive move which prioritizes substance, namely the intent to accept jurisdiction, over form, compliance with the necessary procedures for expressing such an intent. In the same vein, the court held in the Croatian genocide case that even a 2008 decision, that even lack of foundational jurisdiction at the moment of seizing the court, in this case, the fact that Serbia was apparently not a member of the in the UN and not a member of the ICJ statute in 1999, this can be cured if the applicant could have brought a fresh set of proceedings. According to the court, it is not in the interest of the sound administration of justice to compel the applicant to bring proceedings anew. In both cases, Nicaragua and Croatia, it may be speculated that other policy concerns also affected the decision, although, of course, I cannot prove this. In particular, it may have been the desire of the court to underscore its relevance in use of force cases as part of its contribution to the maintenance of international peace and security. Indeed, one may observe a recent trend in ICJ cases of activism in peace and security cases, taking cases on board even in the face of serious jurisdictional challenges, such as in the Bosnian genocide case, or the Croatian genocide case, or the Nicaragua case, issuing rather controversial provisional measures without a clear jurisdictional foundation, for instance, in the third case, which I mentioned before, and arguably also in the latest Prévert case between Cambodia and Thailand, and providing more legal guidance on the substance of the case than the disposal of the case arguably requires. And here I would cite the All Platforms case and also the Wall opinion as indicative of this trend. The NATO use of force cases, however, are exceptional in this regard, and we may be able to explain them or to discuss them tomorrow. The role of policy considerations in determining the scope of a court's jurisdiction may be even larger in cases before specialized courts that operate in the context of a legal regime with a protective agenda, such as human rights or investment courts. In such cases, jurisdictional provisions are sometimes construed with an inbuilt mission bias and a pro-protection propensity, many P's in one sentence, of the court may translate into pro-acceptance of jurisdiction presumption. For example, in Loizido, in the 1995 case, which I have already noted, the European Court of Human Rights decided to reject the reservation appended by Turkey to its declaration of acceptance, alluding to the need to protect the effectiveness of the European convention system against such a restrictive reservation. Arguably, the tendency of many investment tribunals to extend the scope of the term investment and to downplay the significance of the inadmissibility of claims, arguing the inadmissibility investment claims on the basis of contractual choice of forum provisions derived from the same tendency, the same pro-protectionist tendency. Of course, there may be also cases in which adjudicators in specialized courts and tribunals may disagree on what are the true policy goals of that regime, and they may lead to a split in the jurisprudence or even in specific decisions, such as in the Tokyo's Tokeles case. So I have discussed today some of the policy considerations that may affect interpretive moves in delineating jurisdiction and thus engaging in categorical case selection. Tomorrow I will try to expand this framework and to discuss both the application of interpretive and discretionary powers in specific cases involving specific or case-by-case selection, not necessarily on a category basis, but on an individual case basis, and also expanding this analysis to discussion of provisions on admissibility. And on this busy note, I will conclude. Thank you.